Chapter 24. Leave a message after the whimper. Sean was now occupying a functioning invertebrate robot, it seemed. The nono being hovered alongside, his magnificent cape of composite bronze plastic barely touching the cascade of tumble-down boulders Sean's host was balancing perilously on. And, since robots don't have a giddy mode, Sean improvised one, for he saw that the tenuous terrain all around him yawned, as red and bleary as any serious hangover might, into a valley deep below. In all this terrible scene of enthusiastic desolation, there was nothing for Sean optically to get a handle on. "Nono, where are we?" Mr. Being indicated the chaos of jumbled rock on their left, where the remnants of what had been a mighty invertebrate army 11 days ago were waiting for the latest edition of their doom. "This was once Monte San Giorgio." He hovered around and pointed down the talus slope to the chasm beneath them. "That ravine would have held the lake." He opened his arms to embrace the view to their front. "And that, my dear boy, is what is left of our beautiful Lugano." Playing a bit with his telescopic vision he found he was equipped with, Sean could follow the gaze of the cybernetic nono, beyond where the valley floor deepened and flattened inside a triangle of mountains, then up a paradise for scree enthusiasts, to where it all relented into a raised basin. "It has been blasted away by 2 millennia of erosion and chemical bombardment," continued his guide. "Somehow it never fully recovers at each timeline reboot." Sean stared at it in horror. There was nothing but lithic wreckage, careless even by geological standards. Not a man-made thing in sight. Not, that is, until Nono actuated a visual cortex override, and Sean saw it. A kilometer or so from the lip of the basin, what would once have been the shore of Galileo's Cherry Lake, in the midst of the wasteland, was the haunted house. It was exactly the same as it had always been, except that it was now hovering 20 meters above the ground. And since we're on that subject, this, at least what Sean first took to be the ground, was doing something which the word writhing inadequately images. "What is happening, Nono? Why is the ground moving?"
"Because it is not solid," answered Mr. Being.
"Liquid?"
"Not even. In fact, the exact opposite. Think of it as pure negative time energy. But of course it is nothing of the sort. It is intensifying because the timeout is nearly upon us. What you see is the result of a hole which has opened up to the cosmic background, exposing us to the underlying spin mat that cradles this world. The house is drawing everything, space, energy, matter, and the time they project, into what I would call a vortex if I didn't know better. As we approach the timeout moment, this world's space is encroaching on the past worlds, so time is being squeezed out of this side in compensation, and the timeline on the other side of the timeout is receiving it.
In the Timex?
Yes. Condensed time encapsulating in localized spin mat as it surges up. Behold, Sean, the end of the world. Is it not magnificent?
Sean nodded, for it truly was an impressive, if circuitry-ruffling, sight.
"What now, Nono?"
Nono held up the cerebrosphere.
"We must all enter the house, where we will be safe, while this world reboots its time loop."
Just then, Sean recognized one of the invertebrates.
"Centurion," exclaimed Sean happily, "we meet again. How are you?"
"That question has no relevance," replied the advanced model cyborg, with the usual military formality, his metallic casing adding automatic irony, cheap pun intended.
"I'll take that as a well. I'm glad to see you."
"Thank you,"
relented the centurion with an inclination of his cranial servo gyro.
"And I you?"
Sean returned to his nono.
"Why will we be safe inside the house?"
"Because it is not really here. It is the gateway to the Bridge of Sighs, a perpetual no-moment that straddles the two worlds. The past and the future meet and cease to exist around it, but it survives. Ever seen 2 waves slapped together in a bathtub, and your rubber duck gets held up for a moment? Mine does. The house is riding the 2 extremes of the last moment. As the 2 crests of a time shockwave collide, the house becomes trapped in an interchronon cavity, held suspended there by the entropic pressure from the inrush of the 2 ends of the timeline.
Sean looked at the talus slope they were on, the tragic remains of his beautiful Monte San Giorgio, where Leonardo had guided him to the Time Egg cavern. No, why did you bring me here?
This is the last stable bit of land before we reach the house, and I wanted to show you these.
Nonno hovered down and psychokinetically picked up a round stone from the many that Sean only now noticed were being squeezed out of the crannies all around them. Only at close range could Sean see they had a familiar shape.
Time eggs, he cried electromentally, taking the egg. No, these are their exact counterpart. Pure deliquified untime, de-encapsulated in a Spenmat anti-crustacean.
Anti-time eggs? Suggested Sean, wondering what would happen if he dropped it.
I prefer to call them time-void eggs.
No, asked Sean with a shock of sudden guilty remembrance. Where is Mammy?
Inside the house, trapped inside the Vitruvian crystal.
But she disappeared long before the VC was completed.
In a world with a chronoclysm, a timeline shockwave, there is no longer any meaning in the expressions before and after. Chespulio needs consciousnesses to feed the invertebrates. When your mother follows him, thinking it is Pappy, she is trying to find out what the devil he is up to down there in his basement of investment hell.
She follows him through the tunnel and inside the haunted house. There, Chespulio uses the power of the Vitruvian crystal to trap her mind.
He does the same with me, only he waits till just before the VC moment so he can force me to take his place as the mind and soul at the core of the Vitruvian crystal, which is linked to the psychic computer system that keeps this future world operating.
And then he tricks me into falling down the shaft and completing the VC for him, demanded Sean. He'd made me think he was chasing me, so I would fall through the trapdoor into the shaft. He stayed upstairs and took up his position as the last element of the hexagogo.
Yes, he plans it all very cleverly. I'm sorry, Sean. We're all just pawns in Chespulio's evil game,
including the shroud to complete the hexagogo. No, who are the Time Riders?
As the timeout approaches, the power of the Vitruvian crystal increases. Remember the bulldozer driver who tries to knock the haunted house down? As soon as he enters the critical radius, his memory of self is drawn into the crystal, leaving an empty shell of a body. The doctor said he was in a coma, which is just one of the many words people use when they want to pretend they know what is happening. Words like ghost, talent, economic indicator. Anyway, the mind of the bulldozer driver is torn out of him. No mind memory, no person. A computer without an operating system. What I call the deramification of the mind.
Sean sighed. There was so much to learn in nanotechnology. So, who is it?
Stinto. The bulldozer driver is the time rider you know as Stinto.
Stinto? Poor Stinto. And the others? Were they also captured by the house?
Not directly. Two of them are absorbed by the Vitruvian crystal through the sea of time magma forming beneath it. They fall into the grotto, the opening to the time volcano at the heart of Monte San Giorgio here, where you find the source of the eggs. The time magma is a channel to the house, and so they too are trapped.
That very nearly happened to me, agreed Sean, if it hadn't been for Leonardo leaving me the glider and an egg to escape with.
Yes, you see, I have been able to achieve something, even from here.
You helped Leo? Of course. Leo said he could sense your presence when he was in the house. Tell me, Nonno, who fell in the source?
Elf is a Roman soldier in the time of Caesar, stationed at Tremonta, working for the TNT courier service.
TNT?
Sure, Transalpine Nocturnal Transmissions. Their logo is Who Stares Wins. On the mountain here is a Roman military telecom station, the last in a long chain of state-of-the-art bonfire beacons sending messages over the Alps between the northern reaches of the Empire, the Rhine settlements, and Rome, the heyday of the Italian postal system. Anyway, one day Elf falls down a crevice and is never seen again.
Poor Elf.
Yes, and the woman you know as Amour is from the medieval village that disappears. She's convicted of stealing and so is thrown down the chasm to appease the angry mountain tax goblins. It turns out that is lucky for her,
since not long after the whole village is swallowed up by a sudden eruption of chronoclysm and ceases to exist in our world.
How awful!
That explains Stinto, Elf, and a Moor.
No.
Mr. Bing hovered down to look Sean straight in the optical triodes.
You must remember, Sean, that the Time Riders are not people, not as we think of them. The closest you could get is to say they are human self-entities. You see, a person in the completed VC is drawn with it into an orientation with the cosmic background, the Spenmat. Because they're outside of it, time becomes a visible dimension. But a sentient mind cannot function seeing all time. We need the time myth. We need a context and a sense of direction through time to create a memory which explains our existence. But memories are only a virtual reality. They exist as a flux of desires and explanatory logical conclusions. The only option the Shrouds have to escape the Hexagogo is to become Time Riders and to restrict themselves to existing in only a fraction of the timeline and forgetting the rest.
I see, said Sean.
So the Time Riders could only ride through the timeline by inventing an explanation of themselves.
Is that why they thought they had done it many times?
To explain why they knew all our future history?
Yes.
But they didn't have to do that, did they? They could have discovered the truth if they sought it.
They fall prey to what is surely the most unfortunate characteristic of human beings, inventing an explanation for that which they cannot understand, a great source of problems if you're looking for one.
So they just forgot me.
Sean wanted to cry but couldn't find the right circuit.
No, Sean, they cannot. Not entirely. Nor can they forget each other. Your father and mother are very much in love, and they love you dearly.
But Pao was so nasty to me.
He still has the banker in him. He has programmed his brain to make irrelevant anything extraneous to his preset view.
I see. And Mammy?
Your mother, as Jenny, remembers you at some deep level I cannot even begin to understand. Love is not a memory or habit. Love is a deep frequency that a soul resonates with and cannot forget. She feels this resonance in your presence as you do in hers, even though her existence in a specific local time demands she have no memory of any other. And that is why they can never stay too long in any one time. Love transcends the constraints of reality.
Sean was silent for too long.
Sean, don't take it so hard, said Nonno gently,
placing a virtual hand on a cybernetic shoulder.
It's not that, replied Sean. It's just that, speaking as an almost teenager, it is kind of disappointing to find that after thinking I've been romping through history on my own time, so to speak, my parents have been there all along.
Then they both laughed, electronic, wheezy and rotary valve sorts of laughs, but laughs nevertheless. While his gas compressor was recharging, Sean asked,
How long do we have left, Nonno?
Nonno shook his head. He slowly undid the strap and handed the watch to Sean.
Difficult to say. Time is not likely to behave itself as the Vitruvian crystal forms.
Sean took the watch and looked at its display going bananas as the time wave field all around them adopted similarly fruit-inspired characteristics. He thought fondly of the day Nonno had so joyfully explained its six miracles of science.
You know what I think, Nonno?
I think that on the other side of the timeout, right now, I'm heading home through the forest on the flanks of the time volcano. He looked at the Centurion, and a thought struck him suddenly.
It was you, wasn't it, Centurion? You were in the forest when I found the egg. In fact, it must have been about here.
He tried to refigure the shape of the mountainside in his mind.
Yes,
replied the Centurion.
In our legends, this is the mountain of the joining of the ways.
Nonno announced a change of subject by holding up the Cerebrosphere.
We must go now.
Are you coming into the Cerebrosphere too? Asked Sean, hating the idea of leaving Nonno's comforting presence.
No, I must load the Time Riders at the event horizon of the house so they may recreate the Hexagogo.
But wait a minute. There are only 5 Time Riders in the Cerebrosphere. How do you complete the Hexagogo with only 5? Are you...
No. I am in the core of the crystal. Only so do I enter this world while you all pass to the past.
Then I...
No, you are right on the event horizon when the VC forms.
It is Cespuglio himself who is the sixth shroud. There is only one timeout, and it belongs to both worlds. We are destined to comply to his will, and we can do nothing to change it because it has already happened. Be certain, once we enter the house, we are lost to this and any other world. Till the reboot, then it starts all over again, Sean tremored, as the closest a robot can come to shivering. No, no, I want to stay outside. But that is too dangerous, Sean. Beyond here, the ground has already dissolved in most places. It is converting to pure spenmat, and contains no more time. You risk being trapped in a chronological vacuum. I have to take that risk. Inside the house is Schwarzi's inversion of time and space. I can surely do nothing there. I don't know how, but I have to try to find a way to stop this happening before it is too late. You, Mammy, Pappy, everyone is relying on me. But it is impossible, Sean. The time paradox failsafe has us well and truly by the electro short and curlies. It was you, Nonno, who always told me that an imprecise possibility does not necessarily mean an impossibility. Yes, Nonno sounded guilty as charged. I try to cling to that, but I see no solution. You are here because of what happens at the timeout. Ipso facto, you cannot change it and be here to know to change it. That's why I have to stay outside the house. You see, Isaac Newton, told me that without a sense of a future, we are not able to be human. We have to try to stop it. Then I do not say goodbye, because if you fail, not only do I never see you again, but we, none of us, will ever have existed. When a people destroy their future, they also erase their past. Soon we will have only one brief moment left, the world's contracted thus. But, in truth, we never ever have more than a brief moment. That is what defines us, so yes, even though we don't know how, we must try. Sean went to hand the watch back. No, said the Nonno being, you keep the Sangre Al. It is yours. I have been merely its keeper. Before Sean could reply, Nonno added unexpectedly, the Centurion will do what is necessary. After sowing this enigmatic seed, he peered into the cerebrosphere. The souls have all but returned now. That means the war is nearly over. It's a draw, of course. You must hurry, Sean. It seems we must part. I've already activated your levitator. Sean tried this out by stagger-hover-bumping forward to embrace the figure his grandfather was speaking from. Then, with wrenching suddenness, Nonno was gone, flying over the dried lake bed towards the haunted house. Sean watched him all the way, his surrogate electronic heart heavy and fearful, but determined. He handed the time void egg to the robot next to him. Centurion, the extreme being said you would do something for me. The machine inclined its servo unit in compliance, shimmered and faded, then returned. Sean took the egg from the Centurion, and, by the means of an undeniably comic gravity-defined solo, was soon describing a creative course for the haunted house. The lake, Nostradamus's cherry shores, had long gone, leaving a canyon as deep as the mountains around were high. There was nothing of human origin left at all. Every piece of material had been scavenged by generations past to feed the global war machine that had long ceased to require or provide any human material comforts. Denuded of all vegetation, the hills around the town had long since collapsed, creating rivulets of rock debris, talus sculptures for him to navigate over with painful slowness to the house, the last domicile of mankind. Apart from the now disintegrating robots he had left behind on the time volcano slopes, it was the only human artifact left on the planet, and this peculiar normality was emphasized by its location. Hovering at drastically varying height above a heaving mass of time-depleted lava, which had already absorbed most of the planet below, in rivulets turning to rivers of temporally deprived goop, gradually vanishing from sight as light itself gave up even trying to register it. Sean glanced upwards. The day had turned to night, and even the stars were fading to the nothing one assumes the right to expect inside a local universe time warp. The empty husk of the robot Nonno had occupied had fallen from the house entrance, and was quickly becoming part of the erased history of the planet. Sean could only hope his family and friends had managed to reach the safety of the house in time. But what if they hadn't? Oh, the horror of it. But before this nightmare thesis could gain extra merit for enthusiasm, Sean's curiosity beneath the house was rewarded by a killed cat. Schrody lay motionless on an island of temporarily resolute ground, but imminently threatened by the chaos gaining momentum all around. He risked it, and hovered by infuriatingly amateur microjumps down. He felt the effects of time echoes as he approached, collective memories screaming at fates which had long lost meaning, but managed to pick up the little inert bundle of his pet and lift back up to the illusionary safety of the house. And there he sheltered in the portico of the house, where he could sit and hug Schrody as he used to do when he longed for his mother, and watch the whole of existence find an excuse not to come in for work. Then grief and the enormity of the last moments overwhelmed him, and he lamented to the ubiquitous void.
Oh, my masters, my dear, wonderful masters, what a privileged journey this has been because of you. I have been so lucky, but so unworthy. You, Archie, with your daft, funny hat, your bathtub eureka moment, recording your gateway to infinity, your speaky celesti, through that old chiseler, John the Measurer, guiding us through all of history, reminding us there is always something more to search for.
Above him was Leonardo's logo over the doorway arch, Arvo, A-V-O, Amor, Vincit, Omnia. Love conquers all. And Leo, your wisdom and guidance, the beauty that flowed from your mind through your brush and pen. And Luca Pacioli, how sadly your rediscovery of Vitruvius has ended. You never intended any of this.
And Galileo, crazy, brilliant, courageous Maestro Galileo Galilei,
you took the church on alone and beat it, smashed its dogmatic hold on the minds of men forever. Such is the power of speaky celesti.
And Isaac Newton, dear old Sacky,
you did achieve your dream and become a great detective on the banks of the Thames, hunting down the worst the underworld had to offer, leading the gang warfare between the sacks and the socks. But you're remembered most for your laws. You were right, my dear master. Nothing has moved ever since except by your say-so. You, Leibniz, and the Bernoulli bro drew calculus from speaky celesti, and the world leapt forward, away from the dark age of arrogant faiths.
But I'm forgetting the exiest marquis of them all, Laplace. Oh, my dear friend, it was just here in Nonna's doing science room that we discussed so many wonderful things, and you were right. Look, my master, it is exactly as you foresaw. Your blob of dark is here. You took speaky celesti and gave us the cosmos, and invited us to dare to dream.
And your wonderful disciple, dear, brave Carl, here I am, warming my back on your Schwarzschild radius. While you were giving the world your better, brighter reality, the forces of darkness were taking your life to feed the frenzy of illusion, which all my masters have fought as one against. And Mr. Onestone, how funny, clever, and good you were. How bravely you challenged Cespuglio, and all he could do was turn his back and scurry away.
Bravo, Einstein, bravo!
But Mr. Onestone, this is the last circus, the last show for us all. I could not follow your wonderful act. I'm so sorry. There are no crowds to cheer me on. I'm so alone, my dear masters, so alone, and I miss you all. He held Schrody as tightly as he dared. Then he thought he felt her stir.
Schrody, are you now alive? How is this possible?
Here we two belong to both worlds, always have done. He picked up the dead cat and looked her in the face. I've always wanted to ask you why you can never make up your mind whether to be dead or alive. I was never sure, could never be sure what the reality was, till I looked inside your box. The two worlds we live in started for you long before I split them, didn't they? Nonna was right. The concepts of before and after no longer have any meaning, if they ever did. You split the world in two around you, Schrody, without ever knowing it. Sean laughed gently. You split the world in two. He sprang, hovered up, and banged his head on the portico roof.
Eureka!
and ouch.
Suddenly he knew the conclusion to the vague plan he had hatched from the egg on the Time Volcano. Yet still he hesitated. He explained to the dead cat, "Despite the time reboot, we will only get one shot at this. If we get it wrong, Shrody, we will get it wrong for eternity, and that would get a little wearing, to say the least." Despite the bulkiness of the armored suit, he could sense the watch gaining and losing weight as it had done in the tunnel what seemed years ago, but was only a few seconds away, at least according to house rules. He hovered around beneath the house, completely awkwardly because gravity had also taken leave of its senses. In the rapidly growing dark, he moved to the end of the brick tunnel, hanging impossibly enough. The lintel still bore Laplace's warning, "Mind the gap." Most of the floor was missing, so he moved along its wall, as he had done when he had first entered it, looking for his family. As he moved, flaming torches began to appear, as though his presence were changing the nature of experience. At the steps, he stopped. If he ascended, he would pass the Schwarzschild radius and enter the zone where time and space were inverted. Not a good idea for someone who has precious little time left as it is. So he hovered down through a gap in the floor and looked under the stairs. And there he was thankful he could see the earthen outline of the shaft. He hovered over to its raggedly exposed lower end, which in effect provided an alternative entrance to the house. He tried to gaze up inside, looking for a clue, but found it was obscured by an impenetrable screen of light absence. While he held Shrody tightly with his right arm, he lifted his left, hoping that the watch would give him some indication. But the happy little luminous mouse just cheeped away more nonsensically than ever. He became aware that surges from the time disintegration surf beneath him were erasing parts of the robot's superstructure, starting with his feet. He hovered closer to the entrance, terrified but trying to judge the moment. Then he decided it would be dangerous to wait any longer, for as he came to the lip of the shaft, he felt Shrody's form stir again. On this cue, he stopped and waited. His whole body began to shimmer as it threatened to become lava. The reality bubble was popping. It was too late. All around him, the world was lost. Time was turning to matter, and matter to space, and space to energy, and energy to time. The spend mat was reclaiming its own. "Oh, my masters, if you could see me now, what your mind's eye saw while your fellows were sleeping would have been like this. I am both privileged and damned, and embrace it wholly for your sakes." He felt himself drifting away, dreaming of Leonardo and Jenny. Something caused him to shake himself back to grasp the tendrils of reality he still had. "Of course, that is what Leo had been trying to tell me. I'm the figure in Leonardo's drawing of the golden ratio, the Vitruvian man. Better dressed, I'll grant, but in a dance that unites the sphere and the cylinder, inside the square and the circle. I am the shadow between the now and the never. I am naked man at the point of all being and non-being, armed only with the speaky celesti. And it instructs me there are realms of knowledge which are the realms of the gods, and we must earn our trespass." And yet still he hesitated. "This is what it has all been about, all this time. Archie was telling me all along, if you can't measure something for certain, don't make the mistake of assuming you can, but approach it from two sides, so you can be certain of the uncertainty. Newton's infinite limits are here. That's what Leonardo meant by the Vitruvian man. It is me, approaching the infinite point from two sides. I am the receptacle of your wisdom, my dear masters. So long as I remember you, you exist, and we have hope still. And Professor Einstein told me I would have to be faster than him to the pub after work to in-between slip the time wavefronts. But Archie showed me I don't need to be, provided I arrive from both sides. So uncertainty is turned to our advantage." The cat suddenly opened her eyes and meowed her greeting. "Oh, Shrody, thank you, Shrody." And Sean shot up inside the shaft. "Look at me, Leo. Look at me. I am Vitruvian boy."